coming. My name is Bob Whitaker, for those of you who don't know, and I want to introduce you to the meeting tonight, to Dr. Beggs, but also introduce you to what's up here on the screen, Trinity Fellowship, Thinking About Faith at Indiana University. This is a brand new organization that we've started, that we want to have a variety of people, faculty, community folks, people who are students, graduates and undergraduates, to discuss issues of faith as it relates to the academy and the ways in which that integrates. Let me just give you, it's right off of our website. We are very brand new, so you can take a look at that. But let me give you an idea about what we're trying to achieve, okay? Trinity Fellowship is a cross ministry. That's what we call a cross ministry resource for the IU community, bridging multiple Christian traditions. We invite the IU community to bring together faith and learning, number one. Number two, to discover intellectual resources of the Christian faith and equip students for contemporary life. And here's what we desire. We desire to engage in honest inquiry with academic integrity and discuss difficult questions while remaining humble in our conclusions, which in effect means we're going to discuss difficult questions, not ignore them, and realize that in our quest for truth, we actually might be wrong. Second, we desire to promote theological curiosity and to contribute to the common good. We desire to avoid activities that divide us from the very campus culture we seek to serve. We don't intend to be controversial, flamethrowers, or provocative in a destructive way. And we desire to create an environment that affirms Christian truth claims and is generous to those who differ from us. So that's what Trinity Fellowship is about. Again, it's a cross ministry. If I were to have a show of hands, I would probably find someone from every major Christian organization on campus here tonight. And that's exactly the way we intend for it to be. We're starting off very simply this year. And we're starting off with six lectures in 1 year, three in the first semester, three in the second. We've already had our intro lecture, which is gone. Our second one is tonight, and that is Dr. John Beggs. But we have another one in the fall semester that comes up in the Fanjapani room, right? Is that still on, Josiah? We're still at the Fanjapani room. You can take any information that could be found about what's going on is at tfiu.org. So you can get updated on that. But on the 15th of November, we have a panel, and the panel is entitled Truth Claims in a Pluralistic Culture? Right? It's not a statement of fact. It's a question concerning the possibility of truth claims in a pluralistic culture. How does that work? Is it possible? And how do we do it? So we're going to have a three-member panel for that discussion, and we hope you show up for that. Also, we're co-opting with Campus Ministries to put on the Veritas Forum again this year. And the Veritas Forum will probably be a little bigger, a larger space. And the Veritas Forum this year will be Finding Hope Within the Problem of Evil. And that will be a lecture by Dr. Sam Newlands from Notre Dame University. And then after that, we got two more lectures coming up. We do not have the dates or the topics for those yet, but stay tuned and you'll find out what's going on at Trinity Fellowship. So thanks for being here. It's a real honor to have Dr. Beggs here this evening. I think I can call him a very good friend. Over the years, we've gotten to know each other very well and have mutual interests concerning faith and the ideas that come through the university in the academy. Dr. Beggs got his bachelor's degree and master's degree in engineering physics from Cornell University. Did you ever see the sun during the time you were staying
there? It snowed every day.
It snowed every day, yeah. Cornell University. Then he taught math and science at Samoa College while serving in the U.S. Peace Corps. He later obtained a Ph.D. in neuroscience from Yale University. And I was looking at your bio today and realized we were there at the same time and never met.
Oh, wow.
We had to come to Indiana to find each other. He did postdoctoral research at the National Institute of Health. He's currently the assistant professor of physics at Indiana University, where his lab uses ideas from statistical physics to describe information processing in networks of neurons. I have no idea what that means, but I'm sure it's really fascinating to scientists. John, on a more personal level, is married to his wife Sarah, and they have two lovely daughters. I wanted to give you a statement, though, that actually comes from John himself, that I think is a good summary statement of who he is as a scientist and as a Christian. And I hope he affirms that he actually said this, because he's quoted this way. And here's what you say at one point. I just love this statement. He says, as a Christian, I accept and live a life of faith, and as a scientist, I embrace rationality. I don't think there needs to be a huge conflict between science and religion. Much of this could probably be resolved if scientists were more willing to accept that the most cherished things in life cannot ultimately be reduced to equations. And if religious people were more willing to accept that faith is not an excuse to stop thinking. That's a wonderful way to open up this lecture series. Thank you very much.
So I didn't actually say that, but I wrote it. So, all right, well, thank you for inviting me, Bob. And yes, we've been good friends for many years, and I'm really excited that you people have come. And what I'm going to try to do is just tell you sort of a personal story and how I think about these issues. I speak for myself. I don't speak for my department. I don't speak for the National Science Foundation, who funds me. This is just me, okay? All right, so what I'd like to do is basically talk a little bit about my inspiration for why I like science and faith, but then talk about some problems that each of these endeavors, these human endeavors, has. And then specifically, I'm going to look at these three issues. Genesis and evolution, that's kind of a hot button. Ethics. Can evolution explain ethics, or should we look at spiritual sources for ethics? And then I'm lastly going to talk about something called fine-tuning in the universe, and what does that suggest one way or the other. And at the end, I'll offer a way to try to interpret the data that at least makes sense to me. Okay, inspiration. So, isn't that beautiful? So, how many people know what those are? Okay, good. We got a few people here. These are Maxwell's equations. And just to be personal with you, I remember when I was in the library on campus and studying these things out and looking at them, they explain electricity and magnetism. But one of the things that Maxwell was able to find is that when an electric field changes, it changes the magnetic field, and vice versa. That allows them to affect each other so that waves can propagate. And so this little baby right here allows light to occur. So light is an electromagnetic wave. When I saw that, I literally cried. Okay, I am a geek. I have no apologies. I love it. Okay, so I love that kind of stuff. And that's one of the things that draws me to science, is its beauty. There is an amazing amount of beauty in science, and we almost know that an equation, if it's going to be true, it'll have to be beautiful. It's going to have to be compact. It'll be elegant. And scientists search for that stuff. We look for the equation that will explain all of the universe in one unified theory. It'll fit on a t-shirt. That's kind of what we're hoping for, right? Okay. So Maxwell's equations allow light, and then we have this claim. I guess this is a little bit washed out, but that's Jesus supposedly reading a scroll. It's not an actual photo. I am the light of the world. So he says, I am the light of the world. But this is a different kind of light, isn't it? It's a light that I think matters. And so when I started to read about Jesus, I was incredibly influenced by his character. So even if you don't believe that he existed, let's just talk for a minute about his character and what it was like. So his character was that he wanted to love his enemies. And if I look through history, I don't find that in the Roman culture. I don't find that in the Greek culture. If you study Plato and you look at the dialogue of Phaedrus, it doesn't talk about that. It mostly talks about loving someone as if you wanted to benefit them, controlling your passion for a little bit so that you can basically help them grow in their own life. If you look at Chinese culture, you don't find the concept of love for your enemies. What you find is the highest form of love would be love another being as if you were its mother. That's pretty good. But it's not love your enemies. So that's incredible. Now, not only that, but if you do believe that he actually came, and I do, he laid his life on the line for us. He's somebody who actually came down from heaven. So the story goes. I realize I'm speaking to an audience who might not buy everything. But his claim is that he actually had a heavenly position. He was able to remove himself all the way down. He became humble. No one has ever exhibited more humility than that. He was sacrificial. Some of these virtues don't ever realize until you actually do it. You can't say, for example, you're sacrificial until you actually give something up. You can't say you're actually humble until you really lower yourself. You can't say you're patient until you actually wait. These virtues can only be realized if a person becomes flesh and blood and then walks the earth and then gets abused and still loves his enemies and says, Lord, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. So even if you're just a philosopher, I would argue that this kind of love was totally new. It's like he invented love of the deepest kind. And that reverberates even now. Even if you don't believe in this kind of love, the idea of love for your enemies has worked its way into the criminal code. So we have no cruel and unusual punishment. We have a statute of limitations. He's really blessed all nations. And most of the culture that we have today, Nietzsche would even argue this, comes from him. All of our ideas about humanity and loving people and being tolerant comes from this. He invented it in a way. So just as that made me cry, this has made me change my life. That's what I would claim. And again, I'm telling you a personal story. So now I want to integrate these things. I don't want to throw that away. No, I don't want to throw this away either. I see them both as incredibly valuable. So how do I do it? Well, there's problems. So here's a problem. This is Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and here's Charles Darwin. These guys go squarely against each other, right? So do we believe the account of Genesis literally, or should we take it figuratively? One of the most common things that comes up in discussions is, oh, we all know now that the earth is more than 4,000 years old. So how do we handle something like that? Do I have to believe the earth is 4,000 years old if I believe the Bible? Other problems with faith might include some of the ethics in the Old Testament. Go and smite the Amalekites. Wipe them all out. Kill every man, woman, and child. Wow, that's kind of hard to take. Should I really believe the Bible? Another problem that I have encountered with the Bible, and I've been an atheist, and these are some of the things that I thought, is why should I believe this? What kind of proof do I have for this? This is a crazy little book, you know? And there's some people who are really pushing it hard, and I don't know if I want to fall in line with them. Okay, so religion's got its problems. Can we handle them? But science has problems too. So science is not the solution to everything. Let me just kind of say something briefly about the framework of science. What we often do is we think that science is wonderful, and I do, and I practice science. But then with that also can come a set of moral assumptions that science will solve all of our problems. We'll solve cancer. We'll create replacement organs. We'll be able to live for thousands of years. Won't that be great? Maybe not. Okay? We can do all kinds of things. So let's just do a quick little review of some things that science did. So this is from the eugenics board in, I think, North Carolina. So in the early 20th century, there was this idea of eugenics. We knew a little bit about genes. We knew a little bit about breeding dogs and cats and other types of things like that. And so scientifically, people said, you know what we got to do is we got to control the breeding of people. And what we want to do is we want to sterilize certain people for their undesirable qualities and make sure that they don't breed. This is what science was telling us. And at the Scopes trial, which was the whole idea of evolution versus creationism, the textbook that was being discussed actually advocated eugenics. Science said that this would work. And in a way, it did. It was picked up by Hitler. It was picked up by people in the Nazi regime. And what they ended up doing was trying to exterminate a whole group of people. We know. The Holocaust, 6 million Jews. So the science wasn't actually wrong. If you prevent certain animals from breeding or certain humans from breeding, those traits won't be passed on. That science is correct. Why was this then made bad? And why did we drop it? Because of the Holocaust. Because of the moral implications. It wasn't that the science was bogus. It was that it had terrible values attached to it. Science has to somehow interface with values. It needs to be thought about. So you think that's a long time ago. Well, I don't know. How many people have heard of CRISPR-Cas9? So this is about to win a Nobel Prize. People are actually shocked it didn't this year. What you can do now with this technology is you can go in and edit genes. So you can do things if you want to sort of like, maybe you can remove this disease in a particular fetus. That's fine. And then the child will grow up without that disease. That's wonderful. But what if, and we know this is going to happen, what if people start doing things like, I want to change the eye color. I want to change the hair color. I want to change certain other things. I want to give them a voice so they can sing at the IU music school, right? You could do all kinds of things with this. What moral line? How different is that from this? Who should we let use this? If science just marches forward, the promise is that it's always going to solve our problems. That's exactly what people thought at the dawn of the 20th century. What they failed to think about more carefully was the basic depravity of man. We are cruel, we are nasty, we are prideful, we are sinful, and we fight each other. That's my view. And I think World War I and World War II say a lot about that. So if we just march forward with more and more powerful technologies, it may lead to all kinds of moral failings. Science alone can't save us, I would argue. Okay, so that's a potential problem with science. There's other issues that I'll talk about with science in a few minutes. Okay, so basically, there's problems with faith and there's problems with science. All right, can they be harmonized? Well, I think the answer is yes, they can be. I'll tell you a real quick story. I was invited to University of Arkansas to give a talk, a colloquium in the physics department, and afterwards they take you out to dinner. And this is the normal practice. And I'm sitting down at the dinner, and there are several professors and their spouses, and they're all talking and talking, and they're talking about the Darwin Day Club, and they're talking about the local secular society, and they're talking about the stupid Christians and so forth. And I'm listening to all this, and I'm going, oh, man, I don't know what to do. And I'm hearing it, and then I finally lean forward, and I go, I have something to tell you. And I whispered it, and they all leaned forward, and I said, I'm a Christian. And they all kind of dropped dead. They were like, I don't know what to say. Now, because I think they felt really guilty, they were nice to me for the rest of the dinner. And they asked me all kinds of questions, and we actually had a wonderful conversation. And I was able to apologize for the Crusades and other things like that. But they were also able to ask me, like, why would you believe in this stuff? And I said, well, where do you get your ethics from? And we're not immoral. No, I didn't say you're immoral, but where do you get your ethical foundations? We had a really good conversation. And actually, at the end of it, one of these guys came over and he hugged me. And the other guy said, oh, when is your plane leave? I want you to come over for breakfast. So we had a really good conversation. I learned a huge amount about where atheists can get their ethics from, what types of attitudes they have toward Christians, how Christians have hurt them in the past. So I tried to learn from that. And I hope that, you know, we can have this kind of discussion as well. Okay. So, all right, let's talk about a few problems. So number one, Genesis and evolution. I'm just going to go through a few points that I think will at least tell you how I tend to think about it. Okay. So Genesis and evolution, here we go. And then we'll talk about ethics, and then we'll talk about this thing called fine-tuning. So Genesis and evolution. All right, so first of all, what I would say is what gets covered in the media largely is the creationist account. People think the earth is 4,000 years old, as written by Bishop Usher in a certain, you know, genealogy of Genesis. Not all Christians believe that. There's a wide range of people within Christianity who have different views. Some people think you should take Genesis literally. Other people think you can take it metaphorically. There's a huge spectrum. And I would even venture to say that the people who take it literally, who are most often criticized, are the people who were probably in a minority. They're not exactly the majority of people in Christianity. So, for example, an early church father, St. Augustine, he's around 400 AD, long before Darwin, he did not think that you had to take Genesis literally, as pointed out by Francis Collins. So you don't have to do that, even way on, early on. Now, I don't mean to offend people. I don't mean to say you shouldn't take it literally. I'm not up here trying to tell you what to think. I'm just telling you that there's a range of beliefs within Christianity, okay? I don't happen to take it exactly literally at every point myself, okay? But I'm just sharing you my personal story. But I'm also open to thinking about it and hearing about it, okay? A guy named John Lennox, who does a lot of really nice Veritas Apologetics meetings, one of the things that he notes is that it never made it into the creeds of the founding fathers to say that you must believe this, that Genesis is literal. Jesus Christ was crucified, buried, rose on the third day, virgin birth. These types of things made it into these creeds, but this did not. And historically, there's been a lot of wide-ranging views on this, just to make it clear. Okay? So if someone thinks that you pin down a Christian by saying you must take this literally, then I would argue that that's never been really the tradition. Francis Collins, who's the director of NIH and who was instrumental in sequencing the human genome, one of the things that he says in his book, The Language of God, is that he argues that you don't have to take it literally, and that many of the things that Genesis talks about are basically the ideas that God created this all. And we'll talk about this more in a few minutes when we get to the fine-tuning. This idea that God created it, that God set it up, that's maybe one of the main things. Genesis was not necessarily meant to be a textbook of science. So just to kind of give examples to this, Jesus uses metaphor. So we all know that, or I don't know, I shouldn't assume that. But there's a place where Jesus talks about the parable of the sower. Someone goes out and they're sowing seed. His apostles are with him, and afterwards they get with him and they go, "What were you talking about?" And he goes, "Oh, the seed. The seed wasn't really literally seed. The seed means the word of God. Some of it lands on the path. Some of it lands over here. Some of it sprouts up and bears fruit. Others don't bear fruit." So he's talking here about a seed. It doesn't literally mean a seed. It means something. He reveals it. You catch it using a metaphor. So over here in Matthew 17, verse 2, one of the things he says, people are asking him, they said, "Wait a minute. The Messiah isn't supposed to come until Elijah returns." Because there's this prophecy in the book of Malachi that first Elijah will come back, then the Messiah will come. And so Jesus says, well, John the Baptist was Elijah. So what does that mean? Does that mean that we shouldn't take it literally in Malachi that Elijah will come back? You can't interpret it literally. Okay? You have to be able to take it with some latitude. Jesus took it with latitude. Jesus thought that meant John the Baptist. So what I would argue is there are places, I'm not saying everywhere, but there are places where you can interpret it a little bit more liberally. Now, my mother used metaphor too. And let me give you a simple example. So what happens when you've got a complicated process and you want to explain it to a little kid? I can't remember how old I was. I said the usual question, "Mommy, where do babies come from?" And so my mom said, "Well, the daddy plants a seed in the mommy's legs." And I kept thinking, seed, seed, what kind of seed is this? And I ran away thinking, what, literal seed. She was, again, using metaphor, just like Jesus. It's not a literal seed, okay? It meant something else. So my point is that if you want to explain something to a bunch of people who don't necessarily know it, like how do I explain physics to, you know, a relative, an 8-year-old nephew or niece? How do I explain physics to them? I'm not going to whip out the equations and do everything. I'm going to somehow simplify it and use analogy. Almost all of our communication is done by way of analogy. Just think of the word point. What does point mean? Point means I point in a direction. It also means sort of a sharp edge of a sword or something like that. It also means the subject of what you're talking about. What is this? It basically is an analogy that encompasses all these different realms. We're constantly thinking in analogy. If we speak that way, why wouldn't the Bible communicate that way as well? We do it in our daily life. So what I would say, I'm not trying to say blow the whole Bible off, interpret it however you want. I'm definitely not saying that. I'm saying that there are cases where it uses metaphor. And so we should not, or at least, let me retract that. I'm just telling you what I think, okay? I don't want to take it literally at every stage. Okay. For example, the business of Galileo, he got in trouble because there's certain poetic passages where it talks about the earth being firmly founded and God founded it there. And then there was a big disagreement about that. And he said, well, look, it looks like it's moving here. And we've got this idea that the sun's in the center, so I can explain retrograde motion if I believe that the earth is moving. They said, no, no, no. They took it literally at that time, and that's why he was persecuted. I would argue that you shouldn't have to do that. Clearly, some of the Bible is poetic. And then, I think, lastly, I would just emphasize that I don't take everything allegorically. Clearly, Jesus Christ, the Bible claims that he existed. The Bible claims that people touched his flesh. The Bible claims that he ate things. There are eyewitness accounts. Whether you believe them or not is another issue, but clearly the Bible is not trying to portray him as a metaphorical being or merely a vision after he died. So I would say that not everything is allegorical. That's how I would handle the conflict, at least in my mind, between Genesis and Darwin. So that's issue number one. So I think it can be harmonized in some way. I think we can learn a lot from evolution. I think evolution tells us a huge amount of things. Certainly we know viruses evolve. We try to stop them from evolving. It would be foolish for us, I think, to ignore that kind of stuff. We've got to pay attention to that. Okay, ethics. So here's the little icon of all ethics, Socrates. All right. So now here's another big issue. So science claims that it can explain where ethics come from. And it does so in the following manner. The picture here is meant to show a bunch of ants cooperating. So ants cooperate. And so a whole group of ants are going to, like, share food with each other. They'll share water with each other, things like that. So the idea is this. If you have one society that is altruistic and they share things with each other, compared to another society that's stingy and selfish, this society will outcompete that society. So genes for altruism should get selected and amplified. And so we should all be helpful and altruistic to each other. And if we do that, our group will win over against other groups that are selfish. Does that make sense? Okay, that's the general idea. Okay, so there's a whole strand of theory that argues that we can explain all good actions by them being selective for the group. This whole thing is called sociobiology. Edwin O. Wilson is the guy who founded it. But this is also evolution, right? Evolution is not always cooperative. There's some really nasty things that happen. So the cheetah eats the gazelle, and evolution doesn't stop that, right? So evolution doesn't always lead to nice things, but even more importantly, look at this. That's the dodo bird. So that thing's extinct, right? So yeah, you won't find that in a grocery store around Thanksgiving. Although it would be nice if you could get it there. So apparently they were like 3 feet tall and they were very large, and they got killed so much by people who visited the island because they were so meaty and tasty. So the dodo bird's extinct. Well, what happens to its genes? They don't get passed on anymore. All right. So what I'm going to say is evolution doesn't tell you that that kind of thing is going to be ruled out, extinction. And in fact, if you look at the history of human species, what you find, if you believe the evolutionary record, is there's multiple offshoots, including Neanderthals. Why are they not around anymore? What happened? If we're also supposed to be so nice and so cooperative and so altruistic, were we altruistic to the Neanderthals? And what about human beings in today's world? Do we ever see one group of people trying to kill off another group of people? No, that doesn't happen in today's world. No, that's never happened. Do we see one group of people enslaving another group of people? No, that doesn't happen. Right? So absolutely, evolution allows that. So if one group wipes out another, evolution has nothing to say about whether that's good or bad. In fact, it is a successful solution to the equations of evolution, is to annihilate the competing species. That's a successful. Now, you might say, oh, but people would never do that. People know better. Well, like I said, we've already shown examples of people doing that. And if you want to claim that, you're claiming that people are somehow special. Yeah, I'm with that. I believe people are special. Some people don't believe people are special. A lot of people who think that evolution can explain everything are fond of saying that humans are just like every other animal. We use tools, they use tools. We use language, they use language. Humans aren't special. So if you want to invoke the idea that humans are specially altruistic, one, it falls in the face of the facts that we know, but two, I don't think that's going to be a solution for the equations of evolution. You can violate that and get away with it. All right. So the final thing I want to say about evolution and ethics is just this. There's a huge difference between ought versus is. Okay? So when we have physics and we say, okay, I take this apple and I drop it, physics just describes what happens. It says this is how it's going to happen. I let go of the apple, it falls. Evolution, being a part of science, just says this is what happens. What about ought? How is ought different from is? Well, ought has some sort of moral obligation to it. Ought says you should do this. Maybe you don't do that, but you ought to. You should. Science can never tell you what you ought to do. Science is in the business of describing how the natural world works. So if you want to use evolution and claim this is where we get our ethics from, or altruism will naturally pop out of that, what I would argue is that evolution will never tell you what you ought to do. It's a fundamental distinction error here. Is all that evolution can do. It can only tell you what actually happens. Does this make sense? Some people nod if you get it. Okay. All right. And then ought is where we get outside of science. Science can't answer that. What should we do? No scientific experiment can ever tell you that. I don't say to the apple, please, please fall down. It's really what you ought to do. And then I let it go. You don't do that. It either does or it doesn't. Either species survive or they don't. There is no ought in evolution, although Sam Harris, a popular atheist, seems to think so. But most of his atheist friends criticize him for making this particular error. So finally, a story. So we had some friends over, a professor from a department I won't name. And what happened is we were talking, it was a social situation. He didn't know my background, and he started, don't worry, it wasn't me, Bill. So he started talking, he just came in and he didn't know me. He was really a friend of another friend. And he started talking and he said, oh yeah, I love all these recent jokes of the new atheists are just ragging on the church. They're really mocking it. And he said, this is really a good thing. And I said, yeah, actually criticism of the church can be a good thing. It can help people understand what the problems are, and we can grow from that. This is excellent. So he took my encouragement to mean that I was, you know, totally in his boat as far as his views. And so he continued to go on further and further and say some things. And then finally I said, wait a minute. I don't agree with everything you say, and I should give you a full disclosure. I have different views, and I later told him what they were. But I said, let me just ask you a few questions. do you believe there's some sort of right and wrong? And he goes, oh, no, I don't, not at all. I said, well, do you believe murder's wrong? He said, no, not at all. And then I kind of like looked at him funny. My wife, Sarah, was looking at me, and she's like, don't lay into him, John. I said, but wait a minute. If you think murder isn't wrong, why are you so upset about what the church does? So anyway, I think, here's the thing. Many people, and maybe you believe this, maybe you don't, but many people I have talked to, when it gets down to brass tacks, don't actually believe that there's such things as right and wrong. They believe that ethics are just merely expressions of taste. They're subjective things. You like chocolate, I like vanilla. You like to yield, I like to run the stop sign. You respect people, I kill them and get away with it. Right? I mean, is it just that? Now, I'm not trying to say that everybody who doesn't believe in God has completely off-base ethics. I know very many extremely ethical, good atheist people who are better than I am in terms of the things that they do for their community. But what I would say is the question we're after here is, what is the basis of ethics? Where does it come from? What is the foundation? Is it merely expressed in personal tastes? Or is there actually some transcendent thing that is above us all that we should all comply to? That's where an ought comes from. An ought is, we all should obey that kind of thing. Even if you don't believe in God, you believe in some, maybe Kant's categorical imperative. You believe in some principle. So what is that thing? That thing that we all ought to follow is some non-material thing that has sway over everyone. That's what you've got to get to if you really want to have a solid foundation for ethics. So do I believe atheists can be good? Yes. What I would question, though, is I'd like to dialogue about where does the foundation for ethics come from, if not from some transcendent immaterial thing. I'd like to understand, and hopefully people are in the audience who can inform me on that. I'd be happy to dialogue on it. So there's a big difference there. So when I look at ethics, I find it very hard to explain it merely from the science. This is a reason why I'm going to hold on to spiritual matters. And so if you believe that objective morals exist, all that means is you believe that they're not merely subjective. There's something that we all should hold in common that is different from just our personal preferences, from our personal tastes. Okay, that's just a summary of it. Okay, last part. We're almost done here. I'll talk about fine-tuning really quickly. Now, although I am a professor in the physics department, this is not my area. So what I'll say right now is if you ask me a really tough question on quantum field theory, I probably won't be able to answer it. But I'll tell you what I do know from a physicist's point of view. I work in biophysics. So basically, we've got these four forces that govern everything, we don't need to go into all the details of it, but one thing I'll say is this. They vary greatly in strength. If the strong force up there is rated as 1, this guy is about 1/100th of that. That's the electromagnetic. This is about 1/100,000th of that, and this is 1 × 10⁻⁹. Gravity's really, really weak. You might disagree when you fall down and, you know, break your leg or something, but gravity's incredibly weak compared to those other things. All right, these are the things that hold your body together. That's what causes you to fall. Okay, now, what I'm going to say is these forces are really finely tuned to allow life. Really quickly, let me give you an intuitive overview. When the universe started in this Big Bang, and science points toward that because we know that galaxies are all receding from a particular time when they all came, all time, space, and matter was compressed into some tiny little, you know, spot, and everything expanded outward. And we can see the galaxies are moving outward, and basically we can run that backwards and say, okay, here's something had to start. So when that explosion occurred, and actually that's a creation point, right? So a lot of scientists, when that information first came out, they strongly resisted it because they hated the idea that it agreed with the Bible, that there was a creation. Many people thought, no, the universe just always has been. And the evidence for that was struck down once that became clear. So when this thing basically expanded outward, it had to do so in such a manner that it was not too fast. Because if it went too fast, then everything would be very far apart and gravity would never pull it together. And so you wouldn't have star formation. If it did it too weakly, then gravity would come back and bring everything back together again. And so it wouldn't be out there long enough for particles to collide together and then form balls of gases and then form stars. You need to have stars if you're going to have a source of energy for life. So this force, basically, or this thing causing it to expand, had to be finely tuned. It was just a little too strong. This is like one in, you know, billions of billions of parts. If it was off by just that, we wouldn't have a universe that had life in it. It was too strong or too weak by that. So what I'm going to go through now are basically things like that with these four forces. So the strong force holds the nucleus together. If it was 50% weaker, no stable elements would exist but hydrogen. If it was just a little bit weaker, you wouldn't have stars. If it was just a little bit stronger, then stars would explode. And it's tuned to plus or minus 5%, that one force. Otherwise, you don't have stars and you don't have life. I'll go through these very quickly so you don't have to know all the details. Electromagnetic force, positive and negative charges. They have to be almost exactly equal in number. It's better than 1 part in 10 to the 40th. Okay, so that's 10 with 40 zeros after. So 1 over 10 with 40 zeros. If it's off by that amount, nothing happens. Okay. I actually had this as an exam problem on one of the exams I taught in Physics 202 in 2015. I had people calculate what would happen if you had just one extra charge in this massive gas and that one, and the whole universe wouldn't work. Yet protons and electrons are drastically different in mass, and they froze out at quite different times. If we hadn't had this equality, electromagnetic forces would dominate gravity, so no galaxies, no stars, no planets. Again, you get the idea. Things are balanced. 2 to 1 part in 10 to the 40th. The weak force holds neutrons together in the nucleus. If it's just a little bit weaker, you wouldn't get stars. A few percent stronger, too much helium, too many heavy elements, but these two would stay trapped in stars. They wouldn't get out and then interact in planets to form life. The weak force is tuned to a few percent. Gravity, it's the dominant force. It forms galaxies and things like that. It needs to be very closely balanced with the cosmic expansion. That's what I talked about at the very beginning. 1 in 10 to the 60th. So it's extremely fine-tuned. All right? So if it's too strong, everything blows apart. If it's too weak, everything collapses together. All right? So it's fine-tuned by this. Now, you might think that I'm this flaky guy who happened to get tenure in the physics department, and I'm a Christian. It really shouldn't have happened, and I've got really radical views. But no. This is actually common. All scientists pretty much believe this. Okay? So here's a paper by a guy who's not even a theist. And he's just saying, look, all these things are very, very well tuned. It's not just these forces, it's all kinds of other things. The mass of the proton, the electron, other things like that. There's about, 18 of these parameters. This is common knowledge. Here's just a couple quotes. And I decided to pick atheists just to prove the point. That this is not something that only theists made up. So Stephen Hawking is an atheist, and here's a pretty juicy quote. The remarkable fact is that the values of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. The Big Bang clearly has religious implications. But he's an atheist. Okay. Hoyle. A common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect is monkeyed with physics, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. Another atheist. You might ask, why aren't they theists? I don't know. Okay? And here, David Deutsch, one of the founders of quantum computation. If anyone claims not to be surprised by the special features that the universe has, he is hiding his head in the sand. These special features are surprising and unlikely. Okay. Now, I can even speak to colleagues that I've talked with. Okay, so John Mather came to IU. He won a Nobel Prize for the survey of the cosmic microwave background of radiation. I said, what do you think about the cosmological constant being so finely tuned? He said, yeah, it is, but I don't know what to do. I can't ask anything beyond that. It's not science. There's a guy that I was office mates with who just wrote a book on all this. And he says, oh, the Bible's a bunch of fairy tales. But the last line in his book is, are we lucky or blessed? Yes. That's his answer. So the only person you'll find out there who's a little bit skeptical of this is, there's Max Tegmark, there's Sean Carroll. Sean Carroll basically says, oh, I don't think fine-tuning for life. But then I looked up a paper of his, and he says, yes, there is a fine-tuning problem. And then he goes on to explain it. He just doesn't think we know what the conditions are for life. But I would just argue this, that you got to have stars to have life. That's what most people are arguing. Almost everybody agrees with that. So this is not some wacko, flaky Christian position. This is everybody within the field. It's finely tuned. Now, what we don't know, though, is what you make of it. So you've got a couple interpretations. So some people say we're just lucky. That's it. We're just lucky. We're 1 over 10 to the 60th lucky. That would be a little bit like saying you're at a table and you're all playing for a $1 million hand of poker, and one person, one woman, she keeps getting royal flush. She gets another royal flush. She gets another royal flush, and she gets like 9 times. And that doesn't even get up to 10 to the 60th, by the way. That's far from it. She gets royal flush 9 times straight. Do you say, I think you're cheating? And she comes back and she says, no, I'm just lucky. To me, you got to be crazy if you think this is just luck. Something's going on. So the response to this is a pretty radical maneuver. So many cosmologists say, well, here's how we figure it. There's lots and lots of universes. There's like 10 to the 60th or more universes. And in each universe, you get a different combination of constants. And just in all those other universes, you have no life. It's only in this one. That's their answer. That's a radical move. A lot of people think, yeah, maybe we'll find evidence for the multiverse. The multiverse, literally, let me explain it. That means, here's our universe, there's some other universe over here. We can't come in contact with it, at least no way that we know of yet, because it's another universe. It's got a whole other set of laws, a whole other set of constants. And in that universe, there's no life. That's the answer. This is a radical maneuver. So, here's what I would say. For the Big Bang to start off, for it to happen, something had to initiate that. I don't know what it is, okay, but let me just be a scientist and talk about the attributes of that thing. That thing that initiated the Big Bang had to be outside of time. It had to be incredibly powerful. It had to be favoring life. And once the universe got going, it filled all space. Those qualities are, yes, kind of similar to God. Right? Right? It's like being eternal, being omnipotent, being loving, being omnipresent. Those are the classical qualities of God. And so when somebody stands up and says, well, you postulate God, I postulate a flying spaghetti monster, I would say, no, no. There's not a literature on the flying spaghetti monster that's serious. People have not argued this question over the centuries. That's not a serious intellectual question. And it certainly doesn't address this. Bowl of spaghetti doesn't have these properties. Okay, so a few years ago, Carl Sagan, before he died, he said he really wanted to find extraterrestrial life. And he wanted to stipulate what the conditions would be for a signal that really told us that there was going to be extraterrestrial life. And he said it would have to be a highly improbable signal. It would have to be something that an intelligent being could somehow decipher and understand. That's really close to this. It's a highly unlikely situation. It takes a lot of knowledge and wisdom to understand how these things fit together. So for me, that's another way that I can blend science and faith. This idea that when the Bible says, and then there was light, yes, I believe that. The science points in that direction. I think they go completely hand in hand. So here, let's conclude it. Here's the last thing I want to say. It's all about the assumptions. So here's a really interesting statement. William Kingdon Clifford, it is wrong always, everywhere, and for anyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence. Sounds pretty good, right? Let's just get rid of all these fairy tales. There's no Santa Claus, there's no Tooth Fairy, there's no God, there's no Jesus. I have not enough evidence for that. Let's just get rid of it. Can anyone think what might be wrong with this statement? Guess? Yeah, go ahead.
There's no God.
There's no morals in it. That's one thing. It has no moral point of view. It's strictly rational. Yeah?
Where's the evidence for this statement?
Yeah. What evidence do I have for that? It can't even support itself. Okay? It's just saying, he's just saying, here's my edict. Let's all believe in it. He has no scientific evidence that this is supported. Like, what evidence do I have that that's the way to go? It's self-contradictory. It's like these statements that say, this statement is false. If it is true, then it must be false, but if you accept it as false, then it proves it true. So it's kind of weird, right? There's no such thing like this. So what I'm going to say is this. Science doesn't actually work that way. So this kind of statement, although you'll find it in certain atheist books and so forth like that, it never really appears in a serious philosophy course. Everyone knows it's self-referential, so there's a problem with it, but it gets trotted out quite a lot. There's problems with it. Here's what I would say. If you're going to do anything serious, you've got to start with a set of assumptions. Euclid did this when he had his geometry. He had these assumptions, and from these, then he proved consistently, logically, certain theorems. The sum of the angles in a triangle have to add up to 180 degrees, etc., etc. Okay? You've got to start somewhere. So you assume a certain number of things, and from that, then you construct a set of views, or you prove things, and you see if it's consistent with nature or not. And in the case of Euclidean geometry, everybody thought it was consistent with the universe until Einstein came along with his relativity. And then we said, look, here's what Euclid would say. We live in a flat universe. But then, because mass can curve space, these things can work. Then you had non-Euclidean geometries come out. They have different assumptions. And those different assumptions actually better fit the universe than this, although we're kind of close to this, which is strange. But you can have points where gravity bends space-time. Right? So you construct these completely different geometries. They're all internally consistent. You come up with different theorems. Here, the sum of the angles inside a triangle are greater than 180. Here, they're less than 180. They're all internally consistent. But you have to start with postulates. Okay? So what Thomas Kuhn said is that this is how science progresses. It's not about proving this thing, and you've got the proof, and that's it, and get rid of all the irrationality. Science doesn't actually work that way. How do we go from the Copernican view, or from basically the epicycles of Tycho Brahe, where they thought that one circle was traveling upon another circle, and then Copernicus came along and he said, no, I think the sun's at the center and the earth's traveling around it. Two different sets of assumptions, both could explain the data. Why do you do this? Why do you make a switch from one paradigm to another? Well, it turns out that this ends up being more elegant, the Copernican view. There's lots of other things to recommend it. I won't go into all of them. But what I merely want to say is that science actually works more this way than this other way that William Kingdon Clifford talks about. You don't say, prove this, and now we got a fact. That's good. Let's put it on a shelf. Let's get another fact for science and put another one on. No, there's competing worldviews with different scientific assumptions. Some describe the world better than others. So now let me put it to you this way. If you believe that morals are not purely subjective, if you think that objective morals exist, and if you think that the universe is finely tuned, which set of assumptions better explains this? On a materialist, scientific, only science assumption, what you'd say is, I have no reason to believe that morals exist because science doesn't really have anything to say about morals. Okay? The universe is finely tuned? Well, I don't think there's any purpose in the universe. We're just lucky. Okay? That's the materialist scientific worldview. Or you can adopt a different point of view. The different point of view is there seems to be something that was outside of the Big Bang. And that thing outside of the Big Bang values life, and it also seems to value moral judgment. It's important not to kill people unwarranted. So what I would argue is this. These are different sets of assumptions that you can have to explain the data. Which one fits better? It's your choice. For me, I think the theistic view fits, and it doesn't crowd science out. I'm not irrational suddenly. I don't, suddenly believe in every little thing I see. I look very carefully. I probably spend more time thinking about faith and religion than I have about my science. Don't tell my chair that. Oh, this is recorded. Sorry. Okay. Anyway, so basically, that's it. I want to end there and just ask you guys for questions. We can have discussion. I hope to hear contrary points of view. I'm open to that. Thank you. Thank you.